You're listening to Food Confidence, a podcast about approachable health and imperfect food, all for the sake of the next generation. I'm Jennifer Bravo.
And I'm Andrea Paul. We are two non-diet health professionals on a mission to empower parents and caregivers in raising food and body confident kids.
In today's episode, we're speaking with Jillian Tholen, a registered dietitian specializing in sports nutrition, disordered eating and eating disorders, and women's health. She is a non-diet dietitian and practices intuitive eating and health at every size.
In our conversation with Jillian, we talk about the current culture around sports and athletics with kids and adults, and we talk about how diet culture has shown up in those spaces. Jillian also shares some statistics around disordered eating and eating disorders in athletes and offers some advice on how to identify if that's something that your child might be starting to struggle with. And finally, we touch on one of the principles of intuitive eating, which is joyful movement. And we talk about how to incorporate joyful movement into your life as a family. We really think this episode will be a great resource, not only for parents and caregivers, but especially for coaches and really just anybody who's ever identified as an athlete. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll jump right into our conversation with Jillian.
Hi, Jillian. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, we'd love for you to tell our audience a little bit about who you are, what you do, and how you got into it.
Sure. So I am a registered dietitian working in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area in Minnesota, and I'm doing a couple different things right now. I'm kind of the kind of person who likes to have my hands in a lot of different areas at once. That's really what brings me joy and like keeps me going.
I can totally relate to that.
I had a job that was 40 hours of just the same job for like, I don't even know, maybe a month in my life, and I was like, this is terrible. So anyways, I am in dietetics currently. I am doing two different things that are pretty exciting to me. So I have a small private practice that I've been doing for, I mean, not super long, I guess. Probably I'm coming up on about a year, I guess, that I've been in private practice. And so in that, I work with mostly disordered eating and eating disorders, some intuitive eating, kind of coaching, which is really fun and really rewarding for sure. And then also just a little bit of kind of sports nutrition and consulting in that way. I've done talks with local high schools and like running groups as well, just to kind of talk more about, again, things like sports nutrition and how to work with disordered eating and eating disorders in sport and kind of the things that I'll talk about today. But that's kind of my private practice and what I do there. And then I also am the dietitian for what's called Women's Sports Medicine at TRIA. So TRIA is a local orthopedic center, and they started a women's sports medicine program late last year. And I was lucky enough to be chosen or hired by them to be their dietitian to work in that program. And that's kind of like a really kind of dream situation for me, because I love women's health and sports nutrition is really a big passion of mine too. And so being able to kind of have that opportunity to work in that area as an actual job, not just like this dream situation, was really cool. And that's been really neat too. So that's kind of what I do in the world of nutrition. And I guess I also keep my hands in one other little project, which is working at a local running store, which it seems overwhelming. Like I think people are like, how are you doing all this stuff? But that's just a really cool way for me to stay involved in the community, because my history as an athlete is in the world of running mostly. And that's a pretty cool community in this area. And so it's fun to be able to stay kind of more present part of that as well.
Well, that's great. Thanks for sharing that. I mean, it definitely sounds like you have your feet in various worlds, but kind of have created like your own perfect mixture of in private practice and working in a medical practice, and then also like keeping the pulse on like the running community.
The trends.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. And Minneapolis, I've been there. So my mom's family is all like in the Twin Cities area. So I think we chatted about that when we were.
Yeah. I do remember that.
Okay. Yeah. So when we were in New York back in February at the Weight Inclusive Nutrition and Dietetics Conference. And Minneapolis has like really excellent infrastructure. Isn't it kind of one of the top like cities for people doing outside activities, despite it being like in the Midwest and getting crazy weather?
Yeah. Weather is our biggest hurdle in this area. I know you guys can. Actually, side note, I visited Maine for the first time with my boyfriend this summer, and it was amazing. And we were talking about how Portland really seemed very similar to Minneapolis in a lot of ways, just smaller.
Oh, that's amazing.
But anyways, yeah, Andrea, we are so fortunate to have these amazing trail networks and just accessibility to parks and green space. And it would be hard to find a place that I loved more. We have the winters, which are kind of a bummer, but I think the one thing that I will say about that is that not only are we pretty tough, but it really makes the rest of the year and the other seasons so much more incredible, you know, relative to what we kind of endure for the winter. Like we were kind of just talking about, it's been pretty nice here recently. And I think there was like a 70 degree day and just everyone is out. It's so amazing. You know, if it was always 70, nobody would care. But here everyone's like, oh my gosh, it's great.
Yeah. I think we can relate to that.
One of the things I feel like it's the same about Maine is like, because we experience the season so like fully, what ends up happening is you kind of have forced rest, right? You like totally enjoy each season for what it is. And then by the time you're over it, a new one's just beginning. And it's this like beautiful cyclical pattern to life of like this like forced rest or like forced like outdoor activity and all the, you know, all the good stuff.
I think that's so, I so resonate with that too. I've thought about it kind of similar to what you said, and the way that the seasons, I feel like, bring kind of a rhythm to our lives. Like I don't know what I would do if we didn't have seasons. I would not know what time of year it was. I'd be like, what, it's February and it's,
what day is it?
What? It's Christmas? I'm confused. Anyway, I totally agree.
Yeah. Well, so Julian, because you just shared with us how into the running community you are, I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you got into intuitive eating and health at every size, especially because when it comes to athleticism and especially running, there tends to be such a culture around food and diet as well. And so we'd love to hear a little bit more about your experience there.
Yeah. And I can even talk a little bit more about kind of my path leading to where I am right now, because it's definitely been kind of a circuitous route, but as we know, there are a lot of times experiences in life really kind of shape your next step or where you go or, you know, choices you make, especially in a career, I don't know, setting. But so I guess I can back way up too. And this will, I promise, result in talking about how I came to intuitive eating and health at every size. But so I'm from a really small town in Minnesota. I grew up on a farm. I'm the oldest of five kids. And we were raised in like, you know, a food environment that was very normal. Like my parents were great. They were never talking about being on diets or anything like that. We kind of had access to all foods. I mean, we were the kind of family who ate like Raisin Bran as our like fun cereal. So, I mean, my parents were health conscious, I would say, but not to the point where, you know, things were off limits. We always had cookies in the cookie jar. We always had ice cream available. We always had chips in the closet. We didn't really, you know, want for any type of food or know what we didn't have, but, you know, So there was that. And I think we were always really encouraged to be active, but not in a way that felt really forced, I guess. I mean, growing up on a farm, you just like run all over the place all the time and do whatever you want. And that we just played a lot. So when I was in high school, I was a three sport athlete, as you are a lot of times in small schools. And it was definitely something that really shaped, I guess, I think it started to kind of shape my identity in high school. I played basketball and I ran track and cross country. And we had like pretty good coaching, good team cultures. A lot of my friends were also three sport athletes. So you kind of just rolled through the seasons with your friends, and that was that. And I had a period of time, I think I had some success in running earlier in high school. My dad was a runner, so he kind of would get excited about it. And that was, I think, something that he pushed a little bit on me. Not in a bad way, but I think that looking back, that's one of the reasons I ended up going that direction. Because I think I don't know how many kids actually end up in running because they want to. I mean, how many kids really like to run? I don't know. Maybe some do. But anyways, so that's where I kind of ended up and found some success, which then, of course, you know, I think I have a pretty like competitive personality, and that felt really good to me. And then I kind of felt that success, and I kind of thought, well, this is really neat. I mean, this is something that can set me apart and that makes me feel like essentially like I'm special, right? Like special in some way. And so I kind of, you know, kept going down that path of like, well, I want to be a better runner. And there was definitely a point where I went through a period of time where I thought, well, maybe, you know, if I start to control my food a little bit more, I will be able to be a better runner. And I didn't take that to an extreme, like never to the point where I had an eating disorder or, you know, was ever in treatment or even really had anyone talk to me about it. But just enough to kind of dabble in that. But I did end up then having enough success in high school to be recruited by a number of colleges to run, and ended up running in college as well. And I think that's where my relationship with food got a little bit more confused. And also my identity as an athlete became even more strong. So that kind of feels like the perfect storm to me to, you know, kind of it results in some not a great situation. And I mean, looking back, like one of the reasons I'm so passionate about doing the work I do now, which is working with younger athletes and especially adolescent athletes, but also college and older people who are also identifying just as active or athletes, is because I so wish that I would have had more guidance when I was at that point in my life, as, you know, not only a high school runner who maybe had some underlying stuff that it wasn't like crazy bad, but also I mean, it wasn't great either when it came to my body image and my, you know, identity and what I felt like made me like set me apart. And then in college, for sure, you know, we had a coaching staff who was super supportive, but we did not talk about things like this. And I mean, our team culture was pretty good, but also we could have so used so much more guidance in order to foster what would have been a much healthier team culture and, you know, avoid some of the issues that I remember seeing even as, you know, as I got older and as I kind of lived the life of a college athlete. And so now, you know, when I kind of think about the work that I do, which now is with athletes and eating disorders a lot of the time, I think about what I would have loved to know when I was that age. And I think too, I also had the really fortunate situation of doing a dietetic internship that was focused on eating disorders. So I got some really specific training in that field, which I will say, you know, over and over and over again to whoever will listen to me, I think it needs to be part of the dietetics education for everyone. Like there needs to be more than just one class on eating disorders. But anyways, that's another conversation. but I was lucky and got to have that experience, which again, you know, after having the lived experience I'd had felt really close to me and felt like, oh my gosh, this is like, this is work I really want to do because I want to, and I also want to get on the prevention side, because of course, you know, when you're, you know, in all levels of care of eating disorder treatment and seeing the clients and working with them and their families and just seeing their experience, like it's so intense, right? Like you'd never want anyone to get there. And at the same time, like, you know, knowing what I had kind of been through myself, thinking like, oh my gosh, I wish I would have known all of so many things before. So I worked in a couple different levels of care in eating disorders for, I think, 2 years. So I worked actually at the residential level in young adult and teenager and young adult, adolescent, young adult, inpatient eating disorder treatment. And that, again, really was such valuable experience for me. And ultimately, now I'm finally getting to this part of the story, that's what led me, I think, to really being grabbed by intuitive eating and health at every size came a little bit later, I will say. But, you know, just what I saw working in eating disorders and my lived experience and then kind of coming across intuitive eating, which, to be honest, you guys, I don't know how exactly where I found it. I don't know if it was a social media thing or what, but when I found it, I just thought to myself, oh my goodness, this is it. This is so helpful. How do I learn more? Like, how do I spread this message? Because this is what's going to help us to prevent more eating disorders and more disordered eating, and even help people who are already kind of down that path get back to just being able to trust themselves and, you know, have a flexible, quote unquote, normal relationship with food. And so that was really intuitive eating, I think, and how I kind of came to that, even though that seems like that's like a super long story. But
yeah, I think, I mean, I can certainly relate to like the, I don't remember where I came across intuitive eating, to be honest. I remember it feeling like, yep, this is the way I want to do it. So, or do, you know, practice as a dietitian. Can you talk a bit more like how you apply intuitive eating in the sports nutrition setting?
Yeah. So that's something, and I'll be really honest with you, like that's something I'm also really learning about still as I kind of try to hold both, because if we think about intuitive eating, right, we're thinking about really placing the trust in our bodies and kind of releasing all these external cues and things that are telling us when and how much and what to eat in favor of kind of really honing into what our bodies want and what satisfies us and what really energizes us, but also makes us happy in different ways, right? So intuitive eating is very much focused on releasing things like numbers and, you know, external factors like timing and anything that's really rigid or scripted or scheduled. And so that's intuitive eating in one hand. And then on the other hand, you have sports nutrition, which is typically and traditionally very prescriptive, you know, talking about, well, this is how many grams per kilogram of protein you're supposed to have, or this is how much fat is ideal for this part of your training cycle, or, you know, things like that. Or, you know, this is the types of macronutrients you should be eating before and after a workout. So it can kind of seem, I think, at times like the two are at odds. And what I've kind of learned thus far is that combining the two is definitely possible. And it's just going to take a little bit more, especially with sports nutrition, it takes a little bit of like softening of the edges, I guess, is the way I'll put it. So maybe, you know, really focusing on what your athlete's goals are, but also thinking about how does their sport fit into their life, for example. So, you know, that really differentiates someone who's maybe an elite athlete and who's, I'm going to use the example of maybe an older athlete. So they've been in their sport for a long time. They really know what the demands are on their body. They maybe have specific goals when it comes to performance. Then we're going to talk a little bit more prescriptively about our fueling. Whereas if it's, you know, a younger athlete or somebody who's maybe not as specific or high level, and they just really want to understand how to fuel themselves in in a positive way. We'll talk a little bit more openly about more like principles. And so, you know, the way intuitive eating is really guidelines and principles, it's not rules. I kind of try to integrate that in a way with sports nutrition as well. So, for example, you know, if you're doing a workout, you never want to go in underfueled, for example. You never want to, you know, be starting any kind of a workout for your sport not having eaten in the past like 5 hours or something like that. So a principle that you can kind of instruct an athlete on, or I could kind of instruct an athlete on, would be always making sure that you have a snack before you work out, or never going in, you know, I guess we would say underfueled or in a state of starvation, and always making sure you eat something afterwards just to restart that fueling process. And then, you know, from there, depending on kind of where the athlete's at, we can talk more specifically about, well, it's, you know, whether it'd be helpful to make sure that you get some carbs at certain times, or when simple versus complex carbohydrates might be more helpful, or when protein is really helpful. And again, try to kind of hone the amount of prescriptivity. I don't know if that's a word, but kind of hone that in a really individual, or on a really individual basis with my athletes, I guess.
That kind of makes sense? It sounds like it's, yeah, no, that makes sense. So it sounds like kind of bridging the gap between what we know about fueling for sport, but also those internalized cues. And I'm, you know, assuming maybe not being super like rigid with what they choose. Yes, chicken is a great source of protein, but also chicken fingers would be fine too, like for a child athlete or an adult athlete. Like it's not so, it doesn't have to be this like perfect picture of health to be like a properly fueled athlete. Is that kind of correct?
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. And really talking about, you know, I mean, the underlying number one, and I do tell, I think everyone I work with this, but the number one priority is to get enough fuel, is to get enough food, because you cannot build muscle, you can't repair, recover, you can't be an effective athlete, or I mean effective in the rest of your life, if you don't have enough energy. So that's really number one. And then on top of that, it's exactly like you said, it's just kind of figuring out how much need is there for being prescriptive in some areas, and how can we also use principles while at the same time tuning into what makes sense in that context, or what sounds good, or what might be a fine option versus like the ideal or perfect option, you know, and trying to find that gray area, because we also know that a lot of high-level athletes especially are super perfectionistic, and that's one of the – while that's a trait that's admired in athletes, that's also something that can predispose that population to just having struggles and stress around food and fueling.
Mm. Well, that's actually a great segue into a question I have for you, which is what are the statistics around high school or adolescent athletes, even college level – And disordered eating or eating disorders, and kind of like, what's the reality of that situation, and what should we know about it?
Yeah. So we know a few things. So we know that, I mean, and maybe this is obvious, I don't know, but we know that eating disorders are more prevalent in athletes. So just in this isn't necessarily adolescent or older or college athletes, but just in athletes in general, there's one study that compared, just did an eating disorder questionnaire, an interview, and an assessment, and compared athletes with just non-athlete controls. And they found that 18% of the athletes were diagnosed with an eating disorder versus just 5% of non-athletes, which is like a pretty big difference. And then there was another study that was done similarly that showed a similar-ish spread where they saw 20% of athletes meeting criteria for an eating disorder and only 9% of non-athletes. And when we're talking about kind of college level athletes, there was a study that showed that it surveyed a huge number of NCAA Division I female athletes. And this was just females, so not males. But it showed that 1/3 of those athletes had beliefs or behaviors or habits that would predispose them to anorexia or bulimia. So that, again, is a pretty striking number. I mean, 33% of all of our D1 female athletes is – that's crazy.
Yeah.
And one other stat with that, too, is that we know that if the sport has any connection to like a weight measurement, like wrestling, for example, or is in any way like what we would refer to as an aesthetic sport, so something like dancing or figure skating – or gymnastics especially, or is a sport where in some setting or at some point a thinner body or a lower body weight was somehow tied to this idea of improved performance. And that would probably mostly be endurance sports, so running, track and field, things like that. We know that in those sports, the incidence of eating disorders is even higher. So I think one of the studies that I was reading recently was talking about in just comparing the rate of eating disorders in aesthetic sports or, you know, visual sports versus just other sports in general, and found an incidence of 25% of these athletes in these aesthetic sports having eating disorders versus only 12% in other sports. So it's almost double in those sports. And I mean, it makes sense why, but also it's pretty alarming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just as a little quick anecdote, so we were talking off mic before that, like, I grew up figure skating for, you know, 6 or 7 years. I was like pretty into it, but not like super competitive around it. And I remember, I think it was even maybe my first nutrition course in university, and the professor mentioning kind of that higher rate of or risk of disordered eating patterns in aesthetic sports, and her listing figure skating. And I remember being shocked. Really? I was like, what? Because it never even occurred to me. And I think, I mean, that I think maybe speaks to my good fortune of having a good relationship with food, but also right. not... like, it makes so much sense now, but I remember being like, what is she talking about? Like,
really?
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. And yeah. It's interesting too, because I think it speaks a little bit to like what you were saying, Jillian, with the more, at least this is my assumption, so I'd love to hear your if you correct me or not, but you know, like you said about perfectionism, like maybe the more into it you yeah. are, the more dedicated, the more places you're looking to control in order to yeah. up your performance, which is, I think, what you had said earlier, like you're just, if you're in it, you're in it, and you're looking yeah. to tweak all areas in order to elevate yourself and your performance. And so that probably also speaks to your relationship maybe with how you figure skated and maybe right. what you were
a bit more casual.
Looking to get from it. Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't headed to nationals, if that gives you any idea.
Yeah, no, I think, Jen, that's a really good point too. And I think speaks to something else that I can talk about when it comes to, you know, you talked about the stats and, you know, eating disorders in athletes. And one other thing we know, I don't have a specific statistic for it, but we know that the earlier an athlete specializes in a sport, the more likely they are to have body image concerns and maybe eating issues. And I will say another thing that goes along with that is, and kind of like you said, the more into it you are, like the more in it you are, there's that identity piece. And that's a huge part for, it's a huge risk factor for, again, developing these controlling behaviors or maybe subpar or non-ideal coping skills or needs for control. You know, if you highly identify with your sport and you have difficulty finding value or worth in other parts of your life, it's going to be really difficult, you know, to not put everything into that. And then it becomes really difficult also if anything happens, you know, and mm-hmm. and you get injured or you're not the best or what, I mean, whatever that looks like, I guess. But right. I think, you know, when we're thinking about how to support young athletes and kind of protect them from going down this path, it's like you guys were talking about earlier when we were talking off air about how your experiences with sport growing up were super diverse and you were doing lots of different things. Like, you know, I mean, I hear kids will do soccer and ballet and then basketball and hockey and, you know, just do all of these things because they sound fun versus focusing on one thing in order to be the best and someday be an Olympian, you know, like we're not grooming these children from an early age people, that is a thing that happens. But I think, you know, when we're talking about how to raise healthy athletes and healthy kids who just want to be active and move their bodies, it's so much about playing and then also just being able to identify that sport's not everything. You know, as they get older, just talking about what are other amazing things about kids, right, that aren't related to sport.
Right, the performance-based criticisms and
yeah,
praise.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, the
performance. Well, it's interesting too because, I mean, I only have a 2.5-year-old and one on the way, so we're far from any type of sport, thank you, from sports culture, but it does make me think, you know, speaking to other friends who do have older kids and like the environment that exists for sports right now, you know, I'm not totally immersed in it, so I don't know for sure, but it sounds like some of the everyday sports that maybe I participated in when I was growing up have become even more rigorous and even more demanding. And some of these schedules sound as if they are training to be Olympians, even if that's totally not the parent's intention.
Absolutely.
And so I'm curious, like, what's your take on that? And how do we as parents navigate that kind of environment?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I think it really, I mean, I definitely, so I will say I don't have any children at this point in my life. So I can't speak from personal experience, but I can echo what you've observed, and that things like volleyball or soccer or hockey or swimming, you know, these things that, again, when I grew up, they were it was a couple months out of the year and then you kind of moved on to the next thing. Now they're not only year round, but these kids are doing double practices, practicing 6 to 7 days a week, just hours and hours and hours of practice. And I understand the technical skill that they're building and, you know, the fitness gains. I understand all of that. And I just don't know that it seems like a healthy thing for an adolescent athlete to be ever spending that much time dedicated to sport or exercise or training, just because it is such a huge part of their life then. And I think it does become identity so quickly, you know, and it's going to be hard at some point to adjust to a life that doesn't have that level of activity as well, which also seems a little bit problematic to me, especially given the exercise and fitspo and diet culture we live in, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And on that note, I mean, we've talked about intuitive eating and health at every size a little bit. So, and we talk about, you know, diet culture in various forms on this show. So can you talk a little bit about how you're seeing diet culture show up in the lives of young athletes?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the biggest things that I see is, so we know that diet culture perpetuates the belief that the thin ideal is beautiful, thin equals healthy, things like that, right? This very specific and exclusive picture of health. So what I see in athletes is that they're not only subjected to these same pressures of the culture we live in, but also they have additional risk factors on top of that. And so not only are they pressured to maybe look a certain way based on our culture, but also maybe based on their sport, right? So I can use running, for example, just because it's kind of what I know, and also definitely one of the places that I think we see the most eating disorders in sport. But, you know, we see these pictures of, or, you know, videos or whatever, of these elite runners, and I'm a high school athlete and I see like a pro runner who's very thin. And so then I have this idea that, well, in order to be at a high level, I also have to have my body look that way, right? So that's what I would consider a really prevalent message that kind of, it seems like from diet culture, but also we see it in athletes kind of amplified almost, whereas like a thinner body or a more muscular body or whatever, you know, depending on the sport, is equal to or equivalent to better performance. And we also know at the same time that that's absolutely not true. That is not a, it's just not an accurate belief. But that's very much perpetuated. And I think even made more prevalent or more prominent because of our culture. So that's definitely one I would call out for sure. And then on top of that, I think this idea that, you know, and you mentioned this earlier, Andrea, with like chicken fingers versus chicken breasts or whatever, but this idea that like only certain foods are okay to eat and, you know, I can only eat clean, I can only put the best fuel in my body in order to, you know, perform the best. And we also know that that's not true and can so easily become an extreme orthorexic mindset, which again is not going to be, it's just not going to be beneficial for performance. So those, yeah, I think are two of the biggest places that I kind of see diet culture show up in athletes as well.
And Jillian, I don't think we've actually addressed orthorexia very much on our show yet. Would you mind, would you mind just describing it and defining it for our audience and kind of letting them understand exactly what that means, especially in regards to diet culture and athleticism?
Sure, sure. So orthorexia is, it's not technically recognized as an eating disorder in the DSM-5. However, it is recognized as a form of disordered eating, I think, in the greater community. And what it means is just having an unhealthy obsession with eating quote unquote righteous food, or eating clean, or eating food that one believes is healthy. So the clean eating hashtag, for example, on Instagram is going to bring up, you know, like non-processed, just what we would think of as, I guess, quote unquote whole foods. And it's really quick to kind of demonize anything that doesn't fall into that category.
Like chicken fingers.
Like chicken fingers. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing wrong with chicken fingers.
I also feel like a lot of clean eating hashtags are like no grains, no, mm-hmm, no refined sugar, no dairy. Yeah. I think that's, mm-hmm, kind of a common one, but yeah, there's really no, I mean, clean is such a BS term in the first place. So, mm-hmm, we don't, yeah.
It's very troublesome. Would you guys add anything to that definition of orthorexia?
I think it's, the only thing I would add is that it really comes from a place where, at least I've seen specifically coming from a holistic health world, where the access to food is already there and there's not a whole lot of food insecurity. And so when we're pursuing health, we're kind of looking for more answers. And I see people kind of go to like tumble down a little bit too far into wellness and wellness advice and nutritional information. And they're really, really analyzing under a microscope the foods that they're eating. And that is when you start to get into that orthorexia category.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And I guess something else I would add to now as we're continuing to talk about it is, One of the hallmarks of orthorexia is also just really this increased stress when that type of food that's considered healthy or clean is not available, to the point where it really starts to impact functioning and ability to be present in your life and be involved in social situations. You know, it could be avoiding a pizza party because you know that you're going to pizza is going to be there, and that feels really scary because maybe not sure what the ingredients are, or you've heard X number of messages about it, you know, being a processed food, quote unquote.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point to make. And that kind of the isolation that can then come with it and going a little bit too far,
yeah,
towards, you know, disordered behaviors.
Right, which is kind of one of the big hallmarks of a full-blown eating disorder, right? Yeah. It's like that social isolation piece.
So I heard orthorexia will, I've heard rumblings that it will be in DSM-6 whenever that eventually, who knows, maybe in 15 years from now, does get released again. But that it is, like you said, it is taken very seriously among professionals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the way that I see it show up in athletes, again, is just, it's this idea, it's a very, I mean, it, I think it starts as a very innocent thing of like, well, my goal is to be the best I can at my sport. And so maybe even if it's not about weight loss, it becomes about well, I need to get the best possible food. So because that therefore means that then I will perform at the highest possible level. And it definitely is taken to the point where I see very commonly cutting out food groups. And Andrea, you mentioned grains and dairy. Those are two of the biggest ones that I see most commonly cut out. And the irony of that is that they're so nutritious and so helpful, especially for athletes. Like, you need carbs, you know, you need that calcium and protein you get in dairy. And so I think it definitely shows up. And again, from a lot of times from this innocent place of, I just want to be healthier. I just want to be able to perform at my best. And then it's just taken too far and ultimately becomes more stressful. And, you know, it's definitely not helpful for performance. And it can take a lot of unlearning, honestly, and some really intense counseling of how it's helpful that, you know, eat all foods and not feel stressed around, you know.
And one of my biggest like qualms with diet culture is that I think the reason it's so successful at infiltrating people's lives is because we're, you know, hungry for the information around like food and health and wellness. But not everybody goes to a registered dietitian or has somebody that they can oftentimes see. But I would assume that in an athlete's life, that person would kind of be like their coach or their team. And so, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of coaching and staff around athletes, what would you suggest that maybe me as a parent should kind of, what kind of conversation should I have with coaching staff, or what information would you share with a coach or coaching staff that would be helpful for like this topic in combating diet culture?
Yeah. So those are such good questions. I think I would start with you as a parent. I think it's just important to really understand what the culture that your coach, your child's coach is kind of breeding or encouraging. And that could be through talking with other parents who have had experience with that person or people. It could be kind of talking with them yourself and getting a feel for how they operate and the way that they work. But honestly, I mean, I really think talking with other parents about how maybe a coach has worked with their child in the past, or kind of some things that they've noticed, or, you know, if they've been happy with the way that they coach or talk with their children, I think is a huge thing, to be honest. And I think it's hard to know otherwise, unless you're, you know, shadowing a couple practices or hanging out, you know, at events, to know kind of how that coach operates.
Yeah.
So, and then as far as what I would say, or what I've talked with coaching staffs before about, or what I would say to focus on if you ever have the opportunity to talk with a coach or coaching staff, is really to encourage them to not talk about their athletes' bodies. Absolutely never really talking about size, shape, or in any way relating that to performance. And the other thing I would really focus on is making sure also that coaches are really, you know, maybe praising performance, but also being able to talk about their athletes as people. And so they're just being able to recognize, especially as young kids, that they're not just athletes. Again, you know, we're probably not grooming them to be Olympians. What else do they like in their lives? What is important to them? What do they like to do for fun outside of sports? Things like that, just to continue to cultivate that identity that's not just related to sports, so that they know that it's just a fun aspect of their life, but not necessarily the whole defining identity, you know. And of course, little kids probably aren't gonna, you know, hear that super early, but we know that at the same time, kids really pick up on things and internalize them probably in ways far more intensely than we mean or even know. So, you know, just being gentle with those messages, I think, is really, really important.
Mm. And you mentioned, you know, not mentioning body or, you know, things related to the body in terms of performance. And earlier you also mentioned kind of aesthetic-based sports. So like, what would you suggest to parents of children who are in like something like wrestling where they have to be weighed and that is directly related to like what category they're put in and like that kind of those kinds of sports?
Yeah, I think wrestling is a tough one for sure because yes, there are weight classes. So we literally have to use weight as a metric in that sport, which can be really difficult. You know, if I'm ever, I've worked with a few wrestlers and I would always advocate for just doing your best to fuel your body, you know, intuitively as possible and trying not to cut weight and just kind of be able to wrestle at the weight that or exist at the weight that your body wants to be. Because of course we know that that's also going to be the best possible performance situation for you. And I mean, while that's an ideal situation, it doesn't always happen, you know, for one reason or another when within teams. So it's one of those things where, again, you kind of have to give the athlete, the family, the information and try to guide them in a way that feels helpful. And then it's kind of up to them to decide how they want to take that information and roll with it, you know, and you hope that you have a coaching staff too that is, you know, encouraging healthy behaviors and fueling practices that are beneficial for performance, you know, versus cutting weight, for example. And, you know, you're not always going to have that either. So that's a hard situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really good point. I mean, I think it'd be, you know, maybe I'm thinking futuristically and like maybe in a perfect world that a sport like wrestling or any other sports where there's like there's weight categories that they would just blind weigh the athletes and then just, you know, put them into the categories
in the mix
that are similar. Cause I think, you know, as much as we don't want to focus, like even if we don't want to focus on weight, like sometimes just knowing that that's coming, I think can cause some anxiety. Right. And because wrestling or something like that is predominantly a male sport, maybe not so much as it was in the past, and maybe it'll be more split, you know, in the future. But what do you see in terms of male athletes, particularly in sports like wrestling and eating disorder behaviors?
Yeah, so I know that that's one of the things that there's not a lot of research on males and eating disorders, but the more aware we are becoming as a community and as a profession, we're seeing more athletes struggle with these things and be more open with them. There's definitely going to be more research done on males as well as females and eating disorders. And in my practice, I haven't seen as many males as females presenting with eating disorders. It doesn't mean they aren't out there. But it's definitely something that we're becoming more aware of. And even I can mention too really quickly, I don't know if you're familiar with what's known as the female athlete triad, but I think the first time the term was coined was early 2000s. And it's this idea that there's this interrelated triad of symptoms often seen in female athletes that consists of low energy availability, so kind of underfueling, menstrual irregularities or, you know, issues with periods not happening or being irregular, and then also the effects on bone health. So there's this triad that has been recognized for, you know, almost 20 years now, and recently this was kind of revamped in a way that also included male athletes, because we know now that these kinds of underfueling and symptomatic problems related to that, especially seen in sport, don't just affect female athletes. We also know that males struggle with underfueling and they struggle with hormonal disturbances and they struggle with bone health and, you know, performance issues and metabolic issues related to fueling. It's definitely something that's being more widely recognized, which is so important.
Absolutely. And that takes me to a question that might be a little left field, no pun intended, of course, but that makes me think of then okay, so I'm picturing these athletes, these younger adolescent athletes, and I'm picturing, you know, these boys who are, you know, maybe at a greater risk than we assume for eating disorders. But then what about on the other end of that spectrum, which is the picky eaters and the children who maybe aren't getting sufficiently fueled because they are just not as interested in food or the nourishment, like kind of the other end of that spectrum. What would be some recommendations you'd make around that for parents?
I would kind of take a page from the Ellen Satter kind of approach, which would be just to kind of do your best to fuel those kids with, you know, giving them the opportunity to eat, and maybe doing so in a way that you're doing a little bit more catering to what you know they like and will eat, just to make sure that they're able to get the energy that they need. Yeah. Offer for them to try different foods, of course, but I think then it becomes even more important just to make sure they're getting the energy they need, that they're allowed to have that food that really they do go for, you know, and not necessarily worrying too much about, I don't know, whether they're getting every single micronutrient they need versus getting the energy they need. Because really, I think that's really the bigger picture, especially when you're dealing with a picky eater. You know, if they're not willing to eat a lot of the foods that are being offered, or, you know, the quote unquote healthier foods, and they'd rather choose something that's maybe more energy dense or thought of as quote unquote unhealthier, they just want to eat chicken fingers all the time, you know, that's fine.
Yeah, that's such a good point. We'll definitely put the links to Ellen Satter's resources in the show notes, because I think that's something that we'll probably end up doing another show on, because I know we've had a couple questions about picky eating in general. But so, you know, when parents or caregivers, you know, they want their kids to be active, right? They want them to be physically active, move their bodies in joyful ways, or maybe they want them to be, you know, Olympians, who knows, but What kind of language do you think that parents and caregivers should be using around movement and exercise with their children, whether they're, you know, athletic or not super athletic, without kind of like that healthist kind of lens, right? So we're going to go be active because being active burns calories, or being active is making us healthier, you know. I don't know if there's definitely some gray area in that, because, you know, being active is a health promoting thing. But yeah, what kind of language would you suggest that parents or caregivers use around that?
Yeah, I think, you know, kind of like we talked about earlier, I think really keeping it playful and kind of spontaneous as long as possible is really important. So, you know, the idea that, oh, it's a nice day, let's go for a bike ride, or, oh, it just snowed 7 inches, let's go sledding, or let's go make a snowman. Or I think, yeah, anytime you can really just keep it light is super helpful. So then, you know, it's absolutely exercise, whether you're going to walk the dog or getting out a ball and glove and playing catch or kicking around a soccer ball. But kids don't necessarily think of it as that. And maybe that can help them just understand, or just, you know, maybe hold on to that idea that movement is a fun thing to do, and it has nothing to do with the size or shape of their body, or even really their, what we would think of as their athletic ability, but it's just their, something they're born with, this ability to move and, you know, do things together as a family, if that's something you want to do with your kids. But it absolutely, as you said, does not have to involve talk about burning calories or losing weight or gaining weight, or, you know, even things like that, any kind of like healthist or even kind of fat phobic talk that never needs to be part of the conversation. Especially if we're focusing on joyful movement, you know, things that are fun, kind of giving kids the free rein to decide even what they want to do when they're old enough. Like, what do you want to do? What do you want to do outside? Do you want to go outside today? Do you want to play? You know, maybe encouraging it just lightly, because it's, like you said, it is absolutely a health promoting behavior, but never making it something that feels ever like punishment or ever like something that is forced on them, I guess.
Compensatory.
Yeah, or compensatory, absolutely. Like, oh, we just ate that birthday cake. We better go outside and move. You know, even messages like that that I think can easily slip off our tongues because of the world we live in are things just to be mindful of, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like that neutrality piece, that component of, you know, the movement is neutral. It's for fun and for play, of course, but it's not to make up for or to balance anything else out other than just what our body is asking for and wants to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure that's also hard too with maybe what you've seen in terms of the structured or organized sports and finding the balance between, you know, some days you might not want to go to practice, but you have to. And I'm sure that is something that you see a lot in terms of finding that balance.
So Jillian, then if a parent or a caregiver maybe already has started to use the language that we're recommending that they move away from, how can they make that transition into bettering the conversation around movement in a more joyful way?
Sure. So I think that it's really important not only to, you know, make sure that you're kind of avoiding body talk, especially when it refers to or when it involves your child's exercise and your child's body and your child's, you know, behavior in sport. But also, I think it's really important to kind of focus on how you're also talking about your own body and your own exercise, training, food intake, and how that might be, you know, how you may have associated that with exercise in the past, like we talked about a minute ago. You know, if there's been compensatory talk before about, you know, feeling like you need to move your body after eating a certain food, or you know, demonizing one food while elevating another, that kind of talk. Just really making sure that you're kind of in a place where you can do that work on your own awareness of how you're talking about yourself or your own body or your own exercise. And then while also, of course, being mindful of how you're talking about your child's body and exercise and health and sport in that way.
That's great advice. Thank you so much. And
yeah, I think on a previous episode, we had Dana Sukow, and I think she made a good point too about, you know, you kind of fake it till you make it. Even if maybe a parent is struggling with their own body image or their own, you know, relationship with exercise or with food, like you can still kind of fake it till you make it in a certain way so that you're not inadvertently passing on those kinds of negative messages to your offspring.
Right. And I think, you know, we talk about intuitive eating and those principles, and you know, one of those is absolutely self-compassion. And I think, again, I don't have kids, but it seems like it's really a tough thing to be a parent, right? And just wanting the best for your kids and wanting to, of course, do no harm to them with, you know, the things that you expose them to or the way you parent or the things that you say or the way you, you know, carry yourself in their presence. And I think this is a really good opportunity to kind of recognize the need for that as well. Like, just because you make a decision perhaps to be more mindful of the way you're talking about food or body, or kind of take a good hard look at your own relationship with those things or with exercise, doesn't mean you're going to do it right all the time, or quote unquote right, or that there is necessarily a perfect way to do that. And I think it's really important, of course, then to make sure that you're kind to yourself too, because again, we know that we all live in diet culture, and it's hard to kind of even be aware always that we use the language we do, even if we're trying. So just keeping that in mind too. And I think that goes, of course, for coaches as well, like, and anyone who's around children or athletes or, you know, I don't know, living in this world.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, we'll start kind of wrapping things up here. You've given us so much of your valuable time, so we really appreciate it. And you've shared some really great messages. Is there one message in particular that you really want to share or you wish every, you know, parent, caregiver, coach knew when it came to supporting kid and adolescent athletes with their relationship with food and movement?
Yeah, so I think a really big one is absolutely this overarching reality or truth that all bodies are good bodies and your body doesn't have to look a certain way. Because I think that's a really foundational just message for parents, caregivers, coaches to really buy into themselves and to really be able to speak that truth to their children. Because I really think that that's also going to help their kids to kind of embrace the bodies that they have and that they're given. And really by doing that and by working with their bodies and never being in a place where they're kind of fighting their own physiology or trying to manipulate what their true, you know, strengths are, maybe as an athlete or just as a person, maybe through food or movement, they're going to be the best athlete that they can possibly be, right? They're going to be able to perform at the highest level for their body and in their sport if they're able to understand the importance of properly fueling their body and not going to feel like they need to change what their body looks like in order to, you know, perform at a certain level. And on top of that too, just knowing that your kids are more than athletes. Like sport is just one part of our lives and it's kind of like food, you know. Movement is something that can bring us joy and it can absolutely add to our lives and can be a part of our lives, but it just needs to occupy one part. It doesn't need to be more than that. And I think it kind of really goes along in a nice parallel with food in that way of like we want food to be part of our life and it's an important thing. And at the same time, it's just one part. So just kind of reminding them of that as well.
I love that. And it just like that point you make is like an aha moment for me, because when we're thinking about food and nutrition as it concerns athletes, we think that there's like, oh, this perfect equation that we have to fit and find and create in order to achieve this optimal balance. But what you're saying is intuitive eating is tuning into your body. And that is where your body will tell you what works for your body. And that's where that sweet spot exists for performance, mm-hmm. you know, is listening to your body and how it wants to respond and how it wants to be part of sports and movement. I think that that's something that a lot of people aren't really thinking about. You know, that was an aha moment for me when you shared that.
Awesome.
So I love that. Thank you, Jillian. So then where can our listeners, where can we find you and what are some resources that other parents, caregivers, and coaches can turn to for more information about intuitive eating and movement?
Yeah. So I am on Instagram at Jillian, my first name, .rd. And I also have a website that's just jillianrd.com. So those are kind of my out in the world accessible spots. But as far as resources, there are some really good resources online regarding athletes and eating disorders for coaches, trainers, parents. One of the spots that I know has some really good info is the National Eating Disorder Association, so also called NEDA. So that's NEDA, and NEDA.com is a really good place to start. There's a ton of resources there, both just in general about information about eating disorders and disordered eating, but also a really good section on athletes. And then there's something called the Eating Disorders Info Network or Information Network, EDIN, which is another good one. When we're talking about women or girls and women, there's the Lane 9 Project is a really cool nonprofit that's dedicated to raising awareness about underfueling and just issues with body image and especially menstrual disturbances in sport. So kind of trying to start the conversation around those issues that women have, and they're doing some really cool work. So the Lane 9 Project has a podcast and a website that I'd highly, highly recommend. And also there's a group called Strong Runner Chicks that does a weekly podcast, and they're really focused on being body positive, especially in the world of running, which is a super helpful and important platform as well. So those are some of the ones that I definitely know of. I know there are other great ones out there. And as we're, you know, as we continue to have this conversation, I know that we'll only see more groups and resources and things like that pop up, which is awesome.
Well, thank you so, so much, Jillian. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. You shared so much great information, and we can't wait to get it out to the listeners of the Food Confidence Podcast.
Well, thank you again for having me. I have had a great time talking with you both.
Thanks, Jillian. Have a good one. You've been listening to the Food Confidence Podcast. I'm Jennifer Bravo.
And I'm Andrea Paul.
If you have any questions about the things you heard in today's episode or have topics you'd like us to discuss in the future, send us an email at foodconfidencepod@gmail.com or follow us and message us on Instagram at foodconfidencepod.